Without my glasses, can you tell?
Good afternoon, everyone. Dennis did a great job of setting me up by describing a little bit about the Clinical Trials Network. And what I'm going to do is speak to you about one particular large study that was done in the Clinical Trials Network called Starting Treatment with Agonist Replacement Therapies, or START. And I've been squeaky clean for at least the last 12 months. So the purpose for this study had to do with the FDA approval of buprenorphine and buprenorphine naloxone as treatments for opioid addiction. And at the time that the FDA approved these medications, there was some concern about the effects of buprenorphine on liver health. And I'll give you that background in just a moment, but there was an agreement that a phase 4 post-marketing study would be done to assess the effects of buprenorphine on liver health. And the Clinical Trials Network turned out to be the perfect place to do that because, as you'll see, it required a very large study that had to be done in many sites around the country. So the primary goal was to compare changes in liver enzymes related to the treatment of opioid addiction with buprenorphine naloxone, that's BupNX, compared to changes in those enzymes related to treatment with methadone. And I'll explain as we go along exactly what the meaning of the enzymes are. And then we also wanted to look at a whole array of other potential risk factors that could contribute to liver disease in this population of people who are addicted to opioids, who have a very high rate of liver disease, as I'm sure you all know. We'll say more about that in a few minutes as well. So here's the background. This is one particular study that was done. So this involved patients who were opioid addicted and were treated with buprenorphine. And there were two groups of patients. So there were those who were infected with hepatitis B or C, which you see on your, those are the bars on the right, and then there were those who had never been infected by hepatitis. And the ALT is alanine aminotransferase. That's one of these liver enzymes that we're talking about. And basically, these are proteins that are produced by the liver cell. I'm going to a fairly long explanation because not everyone in the audience may have a medical background. But please, if I'm overdoing it, please stop me. So these are proteins made by the liver cells that are involved in different biochemical processes conducted by the liver cells. But what happens when the liver cells sustain an injury or even death, these enzymes are released into the bloodstream, and we can measure the levels of those enzymes in the bloodstream with routine clinical blood tests. And when these enzymes get elevated, that's a sign that the liver cells have been injured. So what you can see here is that among the patients with hepatitis who were treated with buprenorphine, they had an elevation in this liver enzyme after receiving buprenorphine, which led potentially to suspicion that buprenorphine was causing this problem. And out of Europe came 11 different case reports of hepatitis with transaminases are a whole group of these enzymes that we're going to be looking at in addition to the ALT that I showed you in the previous slide. The concept is the same. These are enzymes that are there for another purpose. When the liver cells injured, they get released into the bloodstream. So these, in these case reports, they were anywhere from 9 to 68 times normal, and they occurred in people who were misusing the medication by injecting it, but also in people who were taking it in the proper mode of administration, which is sublingual, or placing it under the tongue. And all these people had hepatitis C. In all cases, either the buprenorphine was stopped or the dosage was reduced, and they all recovered. There was no deaths among this group of 11 people. This is a liver biopsy taken from one of those individuals, and it shows fat deposited in the liver cells, which is a sign of liver injury. It shows these acidophilic bodies, which are indicative of a dead liver cell, and also infiltrating white blood cells, indicating inflammation. And a theoretical model was proposed, and it was studied in the test tube and rat liver cells. This is a little complicated, but the basic theoretical model was that buprenorphine could act as a proton donor or a donor of a hydrogen molecule, and by getting too much hydrogen molecules in solution in the cell, that's basically acid, and that could end up destroying the cell's energy-producing mechanism and killing the cell. Whether this really happens in human beings or not is uncertain, but at least there was a potential explanation. Ergo, we had to do this study. Buprenorphine had been approved and is being used by hundreds of thousands, maybe by now by millions of people, and we really need to determine whether there's any risk there. So here is what we did with the study. It was a open-label, randomized controlled trial comparing buprenorphine naloxone to methadone for opioid dependence. It was conducted in 8 different clinics within the clinical trials network, and they were all places that were licensed opioid treatment programs. And so the patients came in on a nearly daily basis to receive their medications under observation, which was very helpful, so that if we're looking at liver effects, we actually know that they received the medications that they were assigned to. And most medication clinical trials, as you all know, the participants are given some medication to take home for a week or 2 weeks, and they're kind of on their own to take it, and we try and evaluate whether they actually did. But in this study, we watched them taking the medication, and we know when they did and didn't get it. So almost 2,000 people were screened for participation. A number of them were screened out. Almost 1,300 were randomized. And you can see the numbers now. What the FDA requested is that 300 participants in each condition complete the study, which was and completing and being defined as evaluable meant that the person gave liver tests at baseline and over the ensuing 24 weeks continued to remain on medication and also gave at least 4 subsequent blood tests to look at parameters of liver health. They could give as many as 8 more, but they had to give at least 4 more. And almost all of them gave all 8 of the specimens, those who made it through 24 weeks. But there was considerable dropout, and there was more dropout actually in the buprenorphine naloxone condition. So midway through the study, the randomization scheme was changed from 1-to-1 to 2-to-1, which is why we ended up randomizing more buprenorphine naloxone participants than the methadone participants to get to our 300 in each condition. And we'll say more about the treatment retention later on. So our primary outcome is the changes in these liver enzymes. Again, these are proteins that are getting spilled into the bloodstream when the liver cells are injured, and they're called liver enzymes or transaminases. And the primary analysis, which the FDA asked us to do, was this shift table analysis. And I know that this looks very inscrutable, but I can assure you I've been poring over this matrix so intently for the last 5 years. It's the way my grandmother wished I'd studied the Talmud, but I'm quite sure I can interpret it for you. When we get to presenting the outcomes, I will explain it, I'm sure. And the secondary outcomes were all the kinds of risk behaviors that we anticipate that people with opioid addiction might engage in that could cause some potential liver injury. So getting to the participant characteristics, as is common in treatment trials of opioid addiction, about 2/3 of the people were male, and most of them were drug injectors, at least in the last 30 days, probably more in lifetime. Looking at the race and ethnicity, you can see it's mostly white Caucasians, but we did have a good representation of ethnic minorities as well. This slide shows the self-reported percent of days in the past 4 weeks that the participants said they had used various substances. So naturally, they're opioid dependent, so almost all of them had used opioids 80%, or their average use of opioids was 80% of the days in the last month, and They also tend to use other substances, and you can see the numbers there at a much less frequent level than they're using the opioids. Now we're looking at, they gave a urine drug screen at baseline, and we're looking at the percent who were positive for given substances. So the screen for opiates, in case people don't know that, does not detect oxycodone. So you might expect they're all going to be positive for opiates, but some of those who were primary oxycodone users might have been positive for oxycodone and not for opiates. But naturally, at baseline, they all have some type of opioid drug in their urine. You can see the numbers. There's for cocaine, benzodiazepines, and cannabis. Now, the cocaine is one area where our randomization failed, because you can see those randomly assigned to methadone had a higher a higher proportion who had cocaine in their urine at baseline. And we'll come back to that when we cover the drug use that occurred during the trial. Here's their baseline liver health. So about 11% had abnormal liver enzymes at the outset, and the rest of the variables on the table have to do with their hepatitis serology. So hepatitis B surface antibody is an indication of prior hepatitis B infection. And a little bit of difference between the group, two groups, but around 30% had evidence of prior infection. The hepatitis B surface antigen is an indicator of chronic hepatitis B infection. So probably everyone here knows, but I'll just mention that with hepatitis B, people get infected. For the vast majority of people, as we see in this sample, the immune system is able to clear the infection, and they become immune to hepatitis B. For a very small percentage, as we see here, the immune system cannot deal with the infection, and they go on to chronic infection, which is a very serious and usually a lethal illness. Turning to the hepatitis C antibody, that is, again, a screening test to determine prior exposure to hepatitis C, and somewhere between 35 and 40% on average of people in the study had been exposed to hepatitis C. This was actually much less than what we anticipated. We planned the study in 2004 and 2005, launched in 2006, and in the early 2000s, there were reports of people in opioid treatment programs as patients having a 70 to 80% rate of being positive for hepatitis C. So we're surprised to see the levels this low, but actually the more recent epidemiologic data accord very well with our findings here and suggest that the rates of hepatitis C infection in people who are coming into opioid treatment programs are less than what they were historically, which I think is a very positive sign. In contrast to hepatitis C, and again, I'm sure you all know, but I'll go over it anyway, with hepatitis C, the vast majority of people are not able to clear that infection from their body and go on to chronic infection. So HCV RNA are those people among those who've been exposed to hepatitis C who have a chronic infection. Just quickly as an aside, looking at smoking, the Fagerstrom test for nicotine dependence is the most widely used assessment for physiologic dependence on nicotine. It's a 0 to 10 scale with above 4 being moderate nicotine dependence. And so what you can see is the vast majority of people in the study were nicotine dependent and moderately nicotine dependent on average. And that really didn't change during the time they were in the study, despite being in opioid addiction treatment. So this is another whole area that is going to challenge us, that we're going to have to deal with, but not in this particular study. Dosing of the medication. So we're looking at the highest amine dose in milligrams of buprenorphine for the buprenorphine naloxone, which was 22. And for methadone, 93. So these are very substantial, moderate to high doses of the medications. So that indicates that we were using clinically effective amounts of the medication. If there is any liver injury that appears, this would be the type of dosage that would be be occurring in treatment throughout the country and the world. How much medication did they actually receive? 95% got all their medication in week one, and by week 24 it was down to 83%, but the vast majority of expected doses were given. Because there was more dropout for buprenorphine, the total dose years or total amount of exposure was a little bit less than that for methadone. Okay, now we're to the outcomes. And I'll have to explain this difficult table. So basically, this is a shift table analysis, and there are essentially five different categories that people can fit into. They can come in essentially as normal, and we use normal as being less than two times the laboratory defined upper limit of normal, so we gave a little leeway just because for a variety of reasons people can get blips in these enzymes when they have very minor effects on their liver, and we're just trying to give a threshold that's reasonable. So you can, if you consider less than or equal to two times the upper limit of normal as being okay, you can come in okay and you can stay okay for 24 weeks. That's the first line of the table. The second thing that can happen is you can come in okay, and you can go up above that threshold and get worse. And the third line, you can come in on abnormal, the high, and you can then get normal and stay normal for the rest of the time. The fourth thing is you can come in above two times the threshold, but you kind of stay there and don't get better and don't get worse for the whole time. And then the fifth thing is you can come in above the threshold and then get even much worse. But what you can see is all the action is in the first two lines of the table. So about 80% of people came in normal and stayed normal, and that's great. There was a smaller percentage that did come in below two times upper limit and then bounced up above that, which would be the people we're most interested in. There weren't any statistically significant differences between the two medications for that, so there was no indication that buprenorphine particularly caused these kinds of events. And here are the same data, just corrected for dose years because the methadone people got a little bit more of the dose years, but you can see they track very carefully. And really, this is the same information just displayed visually. Those are people who turned from less than two times to greater than two times the upper limit of normal over the 24 weeks of the study. So we looked at, in a multivariate analysis, we looked at what were the predictors of changing from okay at baseline to abnormal during the course of the study. So we looked at the medication condition, alcohol use, tobacco use, drug use, sharing needles, and none of those predicted this change. And what did predict the change is being positive for hepatitis B or C at baseline. And we know clinically that people who are positive for these forms of hepatitis do have naturally sometimes extreme fluctuations in their liver enzyme levels, and that's probably more or less what we're picking up, and it probably doesn't have much to do with the medication at all. If it does have to do with the medication, it's an idiosyncratic reaction that occurs very, very rarely. There were 24 out of this whole group who had what we define as extreme elevations, a 9 in the buprenorphine naloxone, 15 in the methadone condition, keeping in mind that the methadone people had slightly more drug exposure if we think that's what's causing it, although I don't. So they had ALT enzymes with the normal being around 40, so it's anywhere from 10 times to whatever, 62, I can't do the math in my head, but you can, 62, 28, and the AST is also an enzyme that has a normal limit of about 40, so more than 10 times upper limit is normal. And the INRs are a measure of the blood clotting factors that the liver should be able to make. When that's elevated, it indicates the liver is not producing those. Bilirubin is a breakdown product of red blood cells that the liver has to conjugate or connect to another chemical for the body to be able to excrete it. When the liver's ill, that bilirubin level rises. So there was no effect We compared the 24 to 821 who did not have extreme elevations. No effect of things that you think might have an effect, like unsafe injection equipment or even having hepatitis at baseline, because we do get these fluctuations with hepatitis, but they're usually not so extreme as 10 times or more the upper limit of normal. Alcohol use can cause fluctuations, but usually not like that. So the only thing we found, the difference between those who had these extreme elevations and those who didn't, were some hepatitis B or C seroconversions. And when you first get exposed to hepatitis B or C, you can get an acute hepatitis that can be quite severe, and then that usually fades away and goes into a chronic infection, or in the case of hepatitis B, to immunity. And then looking at the self-reported drug use during the first 8 weeks of the study, those with extreme elevations were more likely to be using illicit drugs. And so most likely, if there's any explanation for these extreme elevations, it's either an effect of the illicit drug or some contaminant in the illicit drug that's causing what we're observing. Turning to the treatment retention, I mentioned it was different. It was quite a bit different. It was about 70-plus percent of the methadone participants were completed 24 weeks of treatment, as opposed to about 44% of the buprenorphine participants. And obviously, this is a concern. We don't like to see dropout. We know that the longer that people remain in treatment, the better their long-term outcomes are. And especially with opioid agonist therapy, the vast majority of people who leave treatment end up relapsing. So there are some potential reasons why this might have occurred. We looked at all of our processes. I didn't talk much about inducting the people on medication, but it's a somewhat different process for methadone and buprenorphine. We can discuss that if we have time with the questions. But and we have some qualitative data on why some people left. If we have time, I'll get to that. But this is probably a real finding. There have been a number of particularly blinded comparisons of methadone and buprenorphine, and the individual studies don't show a difference in retention, but a meta-analysis Cochrane review was done, which did show a statistically significant difference favoring better retention with methadone. And there was a recent study of pregnant women that was blinded comparing methadone and buprenorphine, and also there was, in that study, there was better retention on methadone. So this is a real phenomenon that we have to deal with. Now, it's important to point out this was conducted in the opioid treatment program settings, and buprenorphine is mostly used in office-based settings, so it's a different setting, and we can't comment on retention in those other settings. But given the fact that buprenorphine is a safer medication and might have some advantages as a first-line agent, this differential is something we need to address. Now, we also looked at their urine drug screens throughout the course of the trial. And what we found in terms of opiate-positive urine drug screens was a significant difference in the first 12 weeks favoring buprenorphine, with a lower percentage of people on buprenorphine giving opiate-positive urine drug screens. And we found a similar effect for cocaine-positive drug screens. Now, I mentioned these two groups were different at baseline, but in a GEE analysis that uses baseline rates as a covariate, there still was a slight edge for buprenorphine in terms of reducing cocaine use, which is great news for the Clinical Trials Network, since we're about to embark on a study looking at buprenorphine as a treatment for cocaine addiction. So I'm probably at my time limit, but I can stop and sum up at any time if you need me to. So here's some data from our qualitative study. So the people went around to every treatment program involved in the START study and interviewed staff and participants. And I'm just barely scratching the surface of what was found in that study, but here are the patient's reasons for non-completion. The reason the methadone column is blank is everything the methadone people said was common to both groups. But looking at the Suboxone, sometimes people had a rough induction. Sometimes people can get a little bit of withdrawal when they start on buprenorphine, which typically doesn't occur with methadone. And so they don't feel great at the outset, either that can color their expectations or they might even drop out after the first few days. A lot of people, since this was a randomized study, and a lot of people honestly came into the study, they had to, when they did the consent, they had to say they were willing to accept either one, but a lot of people were rolling the dice and had hopes about what they would get, and so a lot of people made a choice to drop out of the study and switch to methadone, or some people just said, I wanted methadone, and so I wasn't happy with what I got, so I left. Maybe more telling, buprenorphine is a partial agonist, and I didn't go into the pharmacology. We can in the question section if you want to, but it doesn't necessarily give the full range of sensation of opioid effects that you might get from methadone, and some of the people said they were not satisfied with that. People talked about inconvenience, and some of that may have to do with dissolving the medication under the tongue. Now, the last item is very interesting. They didn't feel they needed the medication anymore. Buprenorphine has, because it's not a full agonist, has a tendency to make people feel like they don't have a medication in their system and feel very normal, and that can give them the illusion that they're cured and they can just walk away and feel fine, which is not the case because they'll tend to have withdrawal symptoms. Both groups, some continued to use opiates, and then they said, well, I'm doing the same thing I was doing before I came into treatment, so why stick around? These programs do have a lot of requirements, and people have to attend every day, as we mentioned, and for some people that's problematic. Some people do get arrested during the course of treatment. It is hard to get there every day, and a lot of people think they don't want medication long term. So those are some of the reasons why people left. So here's just some quotes from some of the people who were on buprenorphine. I was hoping for the methadone. If I'd gotten that, I'd have stayed the whole 8 months. There's no doubt in my mind. But being that it worked so well as a blocker, meaning the buprenorphine, it didn't work out for me as I stopped. So I stopped. So what he's saying is he couldn't really successfully use other opioids on buprenorphine because it was blocking the receptor and it wasn't what he was looking for. Second quote, when I would take methadone, it would kind of give me energy. I guess I would say, well, the Suboxone didn't do that for me. Just that little bit of not really euphoric, I don't know how to explain the feeling, it just made me feel good, referring to methadone. So she liked the effects of methadone more than buprenorphine. So, again, I can stop at any time. Okay, let me just, I'm going to skip over the genetics part. So, this was a huge operation across the CTN, and you can see thousands of daily doses, 9,600 blood draws. So we found no difference in the liver effects of buprenorphine versus methadone. It doesn't look like either medication causes liver injury. The things that seem to cause a liver injury are hepatitis and ongoing illicit drug use. This was the first large study to integrate buprenorphine treatment into OTPs, and although the retention was an issue, and by and large it was successful. And in this open-label trial with adequate doses, we did see a better effect of buprenorphine reducing illicit drug use compared to methadone. And so a huge number of CTN sites involved, and obviously thanks to NIDA and the Clinical Trials Network for supporting this work. Thanks.